Eustace Mullins, Murder by Injection. Chapter 4, Death and Vaccination. One of the few doctors who has dared to speak out against the medical monopoly, Dr. Robert S. Mendelsohn, dramatized his stand against modern medicine by defining it as a church which has four holy waters. The first of these, he listed as vaccination. Dr. Mendelsohn termed vaccination of questionable safety. However, other doctors have been more explicit. It is notable that the Rockefeller interests have fought throughout the 19th century to make these four holy waters compulsory throughout the United States, ignoring all the protests and warnings of their dangers. Of these four items, which might well be termed the four horsemen of the apocalypse, because they too are known to bring death and destruction in their wake, the most pernicious in its long-term effects may well be the practice of immunization. This practice goes directly against the discovery of modern holistic medical experts that the body has a natural immune defense against illness. The Church of Modern Medicine claims that we can only be absolved from the peril of infection by the holy water of vaccination, injecting into the system a foreign body of infection, which will then perform a medical miracle, and will confer lifelong immunity, hence the term, immunization. The greatest heresy any physician can commit is to voice publicly any doubt of any one of the four holy waters, but the most deeply entrenched in modern medical practice is undoubtedly the numerous vaccination programs. They are also the most consistently profitable operations of the medical monopoly. Yet one physician, Dr. Henry R. Bybee, of Norfolk, Virginia, has publicly stated, "My honest opinion is that vaccine is the cause of more disease and suffering than anything I could name. I believe that such diseases as cancer, syphilis, cold sores and many other disease conditions are the direct results of vaccination." Yet, in the state of Virginia, and in many other states, parents are compelled to submit their children to this procedure while the medical profession not only receives its pay for this service, but also makes splendid and prospective patients for the future. The present writer well remembers the 1920s, as a child in Virginia, going to school for some weeks without having submitted to the compulsory vaccination ordered by the state authorities. Each morning, the teacher would begin the day's classes by asking, "Clarence, did you bring your vaccination certificate today?" Obviously, this was the most urgent business of the educational system, taking priority over such matters as lessons and studying. Each morning, I would have to reply, "No, I didn't bring it today." The other children would turn and stare at this dangerous classmate, who might infect them all with some terrible disease. My mother had been a registered nurse, and she never urged me to go ahead with my vaccination. I suspect she knew more than the doctors about its possible effects. After postponing the dreaded ordeal for some weeks, I was finally led to the doctor like an animal being led up the plank to be stunned, and I received my injection. Of course it made me extremely ill, as my body fought the infection, but the class was delivered from peril, and I was accepted as a duly branded member of society. In The Curse of Canaan, I wrote of the deliverance of our children up for ritual sacrifice, a practice which seemingly ended with the destruction of the Baal cult some 5,000 years ago. Unfortunately, the cult of Baal seems to be firmly entrenched in the present establishment, which is often known by the sobriquet, the Brotherhood of Death. It is disturbing to see how the educationists eagerly embrace each new offense against children in our schools, railing against any mention of morality or religion, while solemnly indoctrinating six-year-olds in the advantages of an alternative lifestyle, in their sexual preferences. The present goal of the National Education Association seems to be that teachers should hand out condoms to the class before beginning each day's activities. The urgency of my vaccination was not that there was any epidemic then raging in the city of Roanoke, nor has there been one in the ensuing 60 years. The urgency was that no child shall be spared the ministrations of the cult of Baal, or forego sacrifice on the altar of the child molesters. The medical monopoly cannot afford to have a single pupil escape the monetary offering to be paid for the compulsory vaccination, the tribute of the enslaved to their masters. From London comes an alarming observation from a practitioner of excellent reputation and long experience. Dr. Herbert Snow, senior surgeon at the Cancer Hospital of London, voiced his concern. In recent years, many men and women in the prime of life have dropped dead suddenly, often after attending a feast or a banquet. I am convinced that some 80% of these deaths are caused by the inoculation or vaccination they have undergone. They are well known to cause grave and permanent disease to the heart. The coroner always hushes it up as natural causes. You cannot find any such warning in any medical textbook or popular book on health. In fact, this writer was able to locate it in a small volume buried deep in the stacks of the Library of Congress. Yet such an ominous observation from an established medical practitioner should be as widely circulated as possible, if only to be attacked by those who can refute its premise. At least it cannot be attacked by the establishment as quackery, because Dr. Snow is not attempting to sell some substitute for vaccination, but merely warning of its dangers. Another practitioner, Dr. W. B. Clark of Indiana, finds that cancer was practically unknown until compulsory vaccination with cowpox vaccine began to be introduced. I have had to deal with at least 200 cases of cancer, and I never saw a case of cancer in an unvaccinated person. At last, we have the breakthrough for which the American Cancer Society has been searching, at such great expense, and for so many years. Dr. Clark has never seen a case of cancer in an unvaccinated person. Is not this a lead which should be explored? With such an impetus, the axe could once again get the telephone banks ringing in the fundraising drives, to initiate positive research as to the possible connection between vaccination and the incidence of cancer. Somehow, we suspect that axe will not follow this lead. It would also look well etched in stone above the imposing entrance to the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center: I never saw a case of cancer in an unvaccinated person. However, it is unlikely that the high priests of modern medicine will be able to give up one of the four commandments. It will be necessary for an outraged public to bring pressure to bear to abandon the modern ritual of sacrificing our children to Baal in a 5,000-year-old ritual called, in its modern version, compulsory immunization. In the land where freedom rings, or is supposed to ring, it is even more surprising to find that every citizen is compelled to submit to a compulsory vaccination ritual. Here again, we are speaking of a civilization which is now being visited by two plagues, the plague of cancer and the plague of AIDS. Yet compulsory vaccination offers no protection against the plagues which threaten us. It is goodbye whooping cough, goodbye diphtheria and hello AIDS. The medical monopoly is searching desperately for some type of immunization against these plagues, and no doubt will eventually come up with some type of vaccine which will be more dreadful than the disease. From the outset, our most distinguished medical experts have proudly informed us that AIDS is incurable, which is hardly the approach we expect from those who demand that we accept their infallibility in all things to do with medicine. Another well-known medical practitioner, Dr. J. M. Peebles of San Francisco, has written a book on vaccine, in which he says, "The vaccination practice, pushed to the front on all occasions by the medical profession through political connivance made compulsory by the state, has not only become the chief menace and the greatest danger to the health of the rising generation, but likewise the crowning outrage upon the personal liberties of the American citizen. Compulsory vaccination, poisoning the crimson currents of the human system with brute extracted lymph under the strange infatuation that it would prevent smallpox, was one of the darkest blots that disfigured the last century." Dr. Peebles refers to the fact that cowpox vaccine was one of the more peculiar inventions or discoveries of the Age of Enlightenment. However, as I have pointed out in The Curse of Canaan, the Age of Enlightenment was merely the latest program of the cult of Baal and its rituals of child sacrifice, which, in one guise or another, has now been with us for some 5,000 years. Because of this goal, The medical monopoly is also known as the Society for Crippling Children. Perhaps the most telling comment of Dr. Peeble's criticism is his reference to brute extracted lymph. Could there be some connection between the injection of this substance and the spread of a hitherto unknown form of cancer, cancer of the lymph glands? This type of cancer is not only one of the most commonly encountered versions of this disease, it is also one of the most difficult to treat, because it rapidly spreads throughout the entire system. A diagnosis of cancer of the lymph glands now means a virtual death sentence. If we suppose that physicians such as Dr. Snow and Dr. Peebles are trumpeting non-existent dangers when they write of vaccination, we have only to look at the court records of many cases around the country. Wyeth Laboratories was the defendant in a case in which a Wichita, Kansas jury recently awarded $15 million in damages to an 8-year-old girl. She incurred permanent brain damage after receiving a diphtheria pertussis tetanus vaccine. Michelle Graham received the immunization at the age of 3 months, and incurred severe brain damage which left her permanently incapacitated. Her lawyers proved that the damage was solely attributable to the vaccine, although Wyeth's lawyers attempted to deny this. Because of the financial prospects, physicians are demanding earlier vaccination for children each year. The Vaccination Committee of the American Academy of Pediatricians recently demanded that the age for children to receive flu vaccine be lowered from the previous 24 months to 18 months. They are promoting a new version of flu vaccine which was said to have been tested on children in Finland. In an article in Science, March 4, 1977, Jonas and Daryl Salk warn that live virus vaccines against influenza or poliomyelitis may in each instance produce the disease it intended to prevent. The live virus against measles and mumps may produce such side effects as encephalitis, brain damage. If vaccines present such a clear and present danger to children who are forced to submit to them, we must examine the forces which demand that they submit. In the United States, vaccines are actively and incessantly promoted as the solution for all infectious diseases by such government agencies as the Center for Disease Control in Georgia, by WHO, USFS, FDA, EMA and WHO. It is of more than passing interest that the federal agencies should be such passionate supporters of compulsory use of vaccines, and that they also should go through the revolving door to the big drug firms whose products they have so assiduously promoted throughout their years of service to the public. It is these federal agents who have drafted the procedures which forced the states to enact compulsory vaccination legislation which had been drafted by the attorneys for the medical monopoly, to become the law of the land. In the dim reaches of the past, when Americans were more protective of their now vanishing freedoms, there was sporadic opposition to the threatened outrage which a dictatorial central government sought to impose on every child in the United States. In 1909, the Senate of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts introduced Bill No. 8, an act to prohibit compulsory vaccine. Sections 1. It shall be unlawful for any Board of Education, Board of Health, or any public board acting in this state, under political regulations or otherwise, to compel by resolution, order or proceedings of any kind, the vaccination of any child or person of any age, by making vaccination a condition precedent to the attending of any public or private school, either as pupil or teacher. No doubt this legislation was drafted by a physician who was well aware of the dangers of vaccination. Even in 1909, the medical monopoly was strong enough to bury this bill. It was never submitted for vote. However, the peril of even one state legislature foiling their criminal conspiracy caused the Rockefeller Syndicate to concentrate on perfecting an instrument for controlling each and every state legislature in these United States. This was achieved by setting up the Council of State Governments in Chicago. Its ukases are routinely issued to every state legislator, and such is its totalitarian control that not one legislature has ever failed to follow its dictates. Edward Jair, 1796-1839, discovered that cowpox vaccine would supposedly inoculate persons against the 18th century scourge of smallpox. In fact, smallpox was already on the wane, and some authorities believe it would have vanished by the end of the century, due to a number of contributing factors. After the use of cowpox vaccine became widespread in England, a smallpox epidemic broke out which killed 22,081 people. The smallpox epidemics became worse each year that the vaccine was used. In 1872, 44,480 people were killed by it. England finally banned the vaccine in 1948, despite the fact that it was one of the most widely heralded contributions which that country had made to modern medicine. This action came after many years of compulsory vaccination, during which period those who refused to submit to its dangers were hurried off to jail. Japan initiated compulsory vaccine in 1872. In 1892, there were 165,774 cases of smallpox there, which resulted in 29,979 deaths. Japan still enforces compulsory vaccination, however, since it is a militarily occupied nation, its present government can hardly be blamed for submitting to the Rockefeller medical monopoly. Germany also instituted compulsory vaccination. In 1939, this during the Nazi regime, the diphtheria rate increased astronomically to 150,000 cases. Norway, which never instituted compulsory vaccination, had only 50 cases during the same period. Polio has increased 700% in states which have compulsory vaccination. The much-quoted writer on medical problems, Maurice Beale, who for years edited his informative publication, Capsule News Digest, from Capitol Hill, offered a standing reward during the years from 1954 to 1960 of $30,000, which he would pay to anyone who could prove that the polio vaccine was not a killer and a fraud. There were no takers. Medical historians have finally come to the reluctant conclusion that the Great Flu epidemic of 1918 was solely attributable to the widespread use of vaccines. It was the first war in which vaccination was compulsory for all servicemen. The Boston Herald reported that 47 soldiers had been killed by vaccination in 1 month. As a result, the military hospitals were filled, not with wounded combat casualties, but with casualties of the vaccine. The epidemic was called the Spanish Influenza, a deliberately misleading appellation, which was intended to conceal its origin. This flu epidemic claimed 20 million victims. Those who survived it were the ones who had refused the vaccine. In recent years, annual recurring epidemics of flu are called the Russian flu. For some reason, the Russians never protest, perhaps because the Rockefellers make regular trips to Moscow to lay down the party line. The perils of vaccination were already known. Plain Talk magazine notes that, during the Franco-Prussian War, every German soldier was vaccinated. The result was that 53,288 otherwise healthy men developed smallpox. The death rate was high. In what is now known as the Great Swine Flu Massacre, the President of the United States, Gerald Ford, was enlisted to persuade the public to undergo a national vaccination campaign. The moving force behind the scheme was a $135 million windfall profit for the major drug manufacturers. They had a swine flu vaccine which suspicious pig raisers had refused to touch, fearful it might wipe out their crop. The manufacturers had only tried to get $80 million from the swine breeders, balked in this sale. They turned to the other market, humans. The impetus for the national swine flu vaccine came directly from the Disease Control Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Perhaps coincidentally, Jimmy Carter, a member of the Trilateral Commission, was then planning his presidential campaign in Georgia. The incumbent president, Gerald Ford, had all the advantages of a massive bureaucracy to aid him in his election campaign, while the ineffectual and little-known Jimmy Carter offered no serious threat in the election. Suddenly, Out of Atlanta came the Center of Disease Control plan for a national immunization campaign against swine flu. The fact that there was not a single known case of this flu in the United States did not deter the medical monopoly from their scheme. The swine breeders had been shocked by the demonstrations of the vaccine on a few pigs, which had collapsed and died. One can imagine the anxious conferences in the headquarters of the great drug firms, until one bright young man remarked, "Well, if the swine breeders won't inject it into their animals, our only other market is to inject it into people." The Ford-sponsored swine flu campaign almost died an early death, when a conscientious public servant, Dr. Anthony Morris, formerly of WHO and then active as director of the Virus Bureau at the Food and Drug Administration, declared that there could be no authentic swine flu vaccine, because there had never been any cases of swine flu on which they could test it. Dr. Morris then went public with his statement that, at no point were the swine flu vaccines effective. He was promptly fired. But the damage had been done. The damage control consisted of that great humanitarian, Walter Cronkite, and the President of the United States, combining their forces to come to the rescue of the medical monopoly. Walter Cronkite had President Ford appear on his news program to urge the American people to submit to the inoculation with the swine flu vaccine. CBS then or later could never find any reason to air any analysis or scientific critique of the swine flu vaccine, which was identified as containing many toxic poisons, including alien viral protein particles, formaldehyde, residues of chicken and egg embryo substances, sucrose, thimerosal, a derivative of poisonous mercury, polysorbate and some 80 other substances. Meanwhile, back at the virus laboratories, after Dr. Anthony Morris has been summarily fired, a special team of workers was rushed in to clean out the four rooms in which he had conducted his scientific tests. The laboratory was filled with animals whose records verified his claims, representing some 3 years of constant research. All of the animals were immediately destroyed, and Morris' records were burned. They did not go so far as to sow salt throughout the area, because they believed their job was done. On April 15, 1976, Congress passed Public Law 1942-266, which provided $135 million of taxpayers' funds to pay for a national swine flu inoculation campaign. WHO was to distribute the vaccine to state and local health agencies on a national basis for inoculation, at no charge. Insurance agencies then went public with their warning that they would not insure drug firms against possible suits from the results of swine flu inoculation, because no studies had been carried out which could predict its effects. It was to foil the insurance companies that CBS had Gerald Ford make his impassioned appeal to 215 million Americans to save themselves while there was still time, and to rush down to the friendly local health department and get the swine flu vaccination, at absolutely no charge. This may have been CBS's finest hour in its distinguished career of public service. Hardly had the swine flu campaign been completed than the reports of the casualties began to pour in. Within a few months, claims totaling $1.3 billion had been filed by victims who had suffered paralysis from the swine flu vaccine. The medical authorities proved equal to the challenge. They leapt to the defense of the medical monopoly by labeling the new epidemic Guillain-Barré syndrome. There have since been increasing speculations that the ensuing epidemic of AIDS, which began shortly after Gerald Ford's public assurances, was merely a viral variation of the swine flu vaccine. And what of the perpetrator of the Great Swine Flu Massacre, President Gerald Ford? As the logical person to blame for the catastrophe, Ford had to endure a torrent of public criticism, which quite naturally resulted in his defeat for election. He had previously been appointed when the agents of the International Drug Operations had ushered Richard Nixon out of office. The unknown Jimmy Carter, familiar only to the super-secret fellow members in the Trilateral Commission, was swept into office by the outpouring of rage against Gerald Ford. Carter proved to be almost as serious a national disaster as the swine flu epidemic, while Gerald Ford was retired from politics to life. Not only did he lose the election, he was also sentenced to spend his remaining years trudging wearily up and down the hot sandy stretches of the Palm Springs golf course. At the annual X Science Writers Seminar, Dr. Robert W. Simpson, of Rutgers University, warned that immunization programs against flu, measles, mumps and polio may actually be seeding humans with RNA to form proviruses which will then become latent cells throughout the body. They can then become activated as a variety of diseases including lupus, cancer, rheumatism and arthritis. This was a remarkable verification of the earlier warning delivered by Dr. Herbert Snow of London more than 50 years earlier. He had observed that the long-term effects of the vaccine, lodging in the heart or other parts of the body, would eventually result in fatal damage to the heart. The vaccine becomes a time bomb in the system, festering as what are known as slow viruses, which may take 10 to 30 years to become virulent. When that time arrives, the victim is felled by a fatal onslaught, often with no prior warning, whether it is a heart attack or some other disease. Health Freedom News, in its July/August 1986 issue, noted that vaccine is linked to brain damage. 150 lawsuits pending against DPT vaccine manufacturers, seeking $1.5 billion damages. When the present writer was a teenager in Virginia, each summer became a nightmare for anxious parents, as epidemics of poliomyelitis, generally called infantile paralysis, swept the nation. Throughout the summer, we imbibed bottle after bottle of ice-cold soda pop to wash down our afternoon snacks of candy bars, with no inkling that we were preparing our systems for the breeding of the poliovirus. The most famous victim of polio was the governor of New York, Franklin D. Roosevelt. In 1931, during the annual polio epidemic, Roosevelt officially endorsed a so-called immune serum, a precursor of the polio vaccines of the 1950s. It was sponsored by Dr. Lindsley R. Williams, the son-in-law of the managing partner of the investment bankers, Kidder Peabody. The Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations had urged the building of a new medical edifice to be called the New York Academy of Medicine. As was often the case, they did not provide the funds, but planned the staging campaign whereby the public was induced to contribute at the millions of dollars for it. Dr. Williams was then appointed director of this academy, despite the fact that his medical abilities were a joke in New York. Williams used this post to become the apostle of socialized medicine in the United States, a goal which the Rockefeller medical monopoly ardently desired, and which was finally achieved when the Medicare program was adopted many years later. In reality, as Dr. Emanuel Josephson pointed out, Williams stood for the political and commercial domination of the medical profession under a socialized system. Roosevelt then announced his candidacy for the presidency of the United States, a post for which he seemed physically disqualified. Because of his handicap, he had been unable to stand or walk for many years. He conducted his business from a wheelchair. It seemed incredible that he would be able to wage a national campaign for the office of president. To allay these doubts, Dr. Williams wrote an article which was published in Collier's Magazine, the second largest magazine in the United States at that time. In this article, Dr. Williams certified that Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt was physically and mentally fit to be President of the United States. It was then bruited about that a new cabinet post, Secretary of Health, was to be created especially for Dr. Williams in an upcoming Roosevelt administration. The immune serum against polio was known to be dangerous and worthless when Roosevelt endorsed it. The National Health Institute of the U.S. Public Health Service had experimented with monkeys for 3 years, using this identical serum. The institute stated that a study of the serum had been made on the recommendation of Dr. Simon Flexner, the head of the institute. The serum was then used, and many children died from it. The New York State Commissioner of Health, Dr. Thomas Perrin, who was later appointed Surgeon General of the United States, who owed his appointment to Dr. Williams' recommendation to Governor Roosevelt, refused to hold hearings to validate the serum, while Roosevelt continued to reap the rewards of charity from his Warm Springs Foundation and his annual birthday balls celebrating the polio epidemic. In 1948, a Dr. Sandia, who was then serving as nutritional expert at the U.S. Veterans Administration Hospital in Ottawa, North Carolina, became alarmed at the enormous amounts of heavily sugared drinks, candy and other sweets which were being consumed by children during the hot summer months, at the same time that the polio became epidemic each year. He conducted tests which led him to the conclusion that the children's consumption of sugar had a direct relation to the virulence of the polio outbreaks. He then issued an urgent warning to parents to ban consumption of any refined sugar product, particularly candy, soft drinks and ice cream during the summer months. The result of Dr. Sandler's campaign was that the number of polio cases dropped in North Carolina 90% in a single year, from 2,498 in 1948 to only 229 in 1949. Aroused by the effect that Dr. Sandler's warning campaign had had on their summer sales in North Carolina, the soft drink distributors and the candy manufacturers came in the following year with a statewide promotional campaign, featuring free samples and other promotions. By 1950, the polio toll had risen once more to its 1948 level. What happened to Dr. Sandia? A study of North Carolina publications shows no further mention of him or his program. Herbert M. Shelton wrote in 1938 in his book, Exploitation of Human Suffering, that, vaccine is pus, either septic or inert, if inert it will not take, if septic it produces infection. This explains why some children have to go back and receive a second inoculation. Because the first one did not take, it was not sufficiently poisonous, and did not infect the body. Shelton says that the inoculations cause sleeping sickness, infantile paralysis, hemiplegia or tetanus. The Surgeon General of the United States, Leonard Seal, pointed out to the annual AMA convention in 1955 that no batch of vaccine can be proven safe before it is given to children. James R. Shannon of the National Institute of Health declared that the only safe vaccine is a vaccine that is never used. With the advent of Dr. Jonas Salk's polio vaccine in the 1950s, American parents were assured that the problem had been solved, and that their children were now safe. The ensuing suits against the drug manufacturers received little publicity. David V. Wyeth Labs, a suit involving type 3 Sabin polio vaccine, was judged in favor of the plaintiff, David. A suit against Ledell Lab involving Oramian vaccine was settled in 1962 for $10,000. In two cases, involving Park Davis Quadrigen, the product was found to be defective. In 1962, Park Davis halted all production of Quadrigen. The medical owner, Dr. William Koch, declared that the injection of any serum, vaccine, or even penicillin has shown a very marked increase in the incidence of polio, at least by 400%. The Center for Disease Control stayed out of sight for some time after the Great Swine Flu Massacre, only to emerge more stridently than ever with a new national scare program on the dangers of another plague, which was named Legionnaire's Disease, after an outbreak at the Bellevue Stratford Hotel in Philadelphia. Apparently, this virus multiplied in the air conditioning and heating systems of some older hotels in large cities, probably because the vents were never cleaned. In a few isolated instances, it caused death to those who were afflicted. For some reason, these victims were usually elderly legionnaires, who had attended a gathering at one of these hotels. As the older hotels were gradually replaced by new, more modern motels, Legionnaire's disease quietly faded away, without the Disease Control Center being able to bring off another $135 million coup for the Rockefeller medical monopoly. polio vaccination has now been accepted as a fact of life by the American public, which derives considerable comfort from the gradual disappearance of the annual scare campaign at the beginning of each summer. However, The Washington Post of January 26, 1988 featured a story which created some puzzling afterthoughts. It was announced at a national conference held in Washington that all cases of polio since 1979 had been caused by the polio vaccine. We quote, "In fact, all the cases in America come from the vaccine. The naturally occurring, or wild type, poliovirus has not been shown to cause a single case of polio in the United States since 1979. It was to confront this unpleasant fact that the Institute of Medicine, under contract to the U.S. Public Health Service, had convened a committee in Washington to review the current use of polio vaccine. You thought they would vote to discontinue it, perhaps? This would be a logical conclusion. Unfortunately, logic plays no part in such deliberations." The Post reported that no radical change is expected. "The status quo is very appealing," said conference chairman Dr. Frederick Robbins, of Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. "This story raises more questions than it answers. It also reveals the wide gap between the medical mind and that of the layman. A layman would say, if all cases of polio in the United States since 1979 have been caused by the polio vaccine, isn't this a good reason for discontinuing? Such reasoning is always called simplistic by our overeducated professionals. After all, one has to think of the national economy, and of drug manufacturers geared up to the continuous production of a vaccine for an epidemic which has disappeared. Think of the unemployment, and the diminution of dividends to the holders of stock in the drug trust. After all, most of their income is donated to charity. If you cannot see the logic of this reasoning, you will never get a job with the U.S. Public Health Service."